What was for sure, though, was that the Canal and River Trust desperately needed the funds from fishing permits to keep all their important work going. So, feeling like a first-class pisder, I sheepishly promised to make a donation to the Trust and swore I would never fish again without double, triple checking I had the right permits. Sometimes in life it isn't the threat of trouble or getting caught out that makes you follow the rules, but actually the idea that you might not be taking your very own opportunity to help preserve something you love. Storm Barney gave way to Storm Desmond, and the rain did not stop until the middle of January. I'd arranged to fish with the wonderful-sounding Perch Fishers Club on the River Ivel in December, but the weather soon put paid to that, and with John Ellis's ringing endorsement in my ears, I decided the time was probably right to try another canal for my next predator. I'd made a start in my quest, but really, in terms of catching a record, my time with the perch had been an absolute failure. This was obviously going to be a lot harder than I thought, and there are no advancements in fishing tackle or increases in the number of specimen fish that were going to gift me a first-class catch without a great deal of hard graft and sacrifice beforehand. Still, I had made a start and thoroughly enjoyed targeting something new, and that definitely counted for something. My grandma passed away that Christmas. It was heartbreaking, but dementia had taken a hold on her to such an extent that this utterly charming and dignified lady had been reduced to just two sentences. "I'm managing," and "yes, boss." Grandma and Grandad had been happily married for over 60 years, the pair of them champions of the life and love that could be extracted from our waterways, him from the end of his rod, her from the tip of her paintbrush. 20 years ago, Grandad caught a truly big perch. You should have seen it, Will. It was massive. I remember him splaying out his palms as if he were holding aloft a priceless china plate, reenacting the precious moment he had held it for the very first time. I dearly wished I had only been there to witness it. His finest captures always seemed to happen away from me. I wasn't even sure it had actually happened. I should clarify, Grandad was no liar. He had definitely caught a big perch, but we're both fishermen after all. Memories blur, and sometimes the distance between our palms can widen with time. Grandma left behind an old plastic ice cream tub filled with pictures when she departed, and right there, somewhere in the middle, I found a picture of Grandad with his most magnificent perch. I hold that image between my fingers as I type this. That picture is more precious to me now than any big perch of my own. The fish's stripes are a darker shade of green than the stripes on his jumper. He props up the perch's dorsal with the tip of one of his big thumbs, and his mouth is wide open in a self-satisfied and slightly stunned grin. It is a Wilson mega specimen, and I am in absolutely no doubt he caught it on a lobworm. The Water Wolf. When I was around 9 years old, I owned one VHS tape that I kept specifically for Mum to record John Wilson's Go Fishing series on, direct from the TV. There was one episode in particular, filmed, I think, somewhere in the Norfolk Broads, that I had watched so many times that the tape itself had started to warp and go fuzzy. I could recall that episode near verbatim. In fact, I'm pretty sure I still can. The episode begins with a slightly awkward hello from a thick-rimmed, bespectacled gentleman who bore more than a passing resemblance to a giant land tortoise. I didn't realise at the time that this was, in fact, the legendary Dick Walker, a true fishing icon. In this film, Mr. Walker was playing the role of surrogate granddad to the thousands of young fisherfolk tuning in across the nation, explaining the rudiments of pike angling and biology in a safe environment before the hero, John Wilson, took over at the sharper end of the spear. "Pike are predators, and they're scavengers too," he begins, with a grim-looking stuffed pike staring on blankly from the wall behind. "They are very well equipped indeed for both jobs," he continued. "They will eat practically anything, dead or alive, that will give them some nutriment." A pencil-drawn otter is framed over one of the old man's great oaken shoulders, and ancient-looking books surround him. Everything about this office, from the interior to Dick himself, Looks like it has been dipped in sepia and warmed up with wood smoke. It was the sort of place where I wanted to be for all time, and I poured my consciousness into its cozy security to such an extent that I could well believe Mr. Walker was addressing me directly, from right across his well-worn hardwood table to the rug of my parents' lounge, where I would sit, cross-legged, inches from the TV screen. "Now, here you see what I've been talking about," continues Mr. Walker. He reaches down and produces the giant head of a stuffed pike. The warming atmosphere of Dick's den is extinguished in an instant. A brooding malevolence creeps into his office, and my sense of longing quietly tiptoes back out. Mr. Walker works the head carefully around his fingers, gradually illuminating the business end in the dull light of his table lamp. He says it is from a 43-pound giant caught in Ireland, but all I can recall is its enormous jaws. Row upon row of razor-sharp fangs along the jawline, backed up by hundreds more, pinned hard to the roof of the fish's mouth. Mr. Walker notes how all the teeth angle slightly backwards towards its blackened throat. "Whatever goes in there isn't ever coming out," I thought. "Never put your hand in a pike's mouth," says Mr. Walker, while clearly running his own thumbs and fingers over the teeth. He was my kind of man. The film cuts to the heroic Wilson rowing his way alongside a tall reed bed. There is a vast expanse of wild-looking fresh water opening out right behind him. It's February, it's bleak, and even he says it's cold. So just what is he doing in that tiny wooden rowing boat with just a tweed hat for company? I grip the remote tightly and pray nothing bad happens to John. Somewhere along the edge of the deep water, he drops anchor and plucks a small live roach out of a bait tin. He says something nonchalant about only using small live baits these days, but I can't help noticing that the roach he has selected is actually the same size as my personal best from the creek. A highly unpleasant sense of shame burns at my cheeks, a feeling I later learned to interpret as a sense of inferiority combined with instant emasculation. I remember how it felt to land that best ever roach. The euphoric, championship-winning sensation carried me through the whole summer, and the glow stayed with me every night I closed my eyes and thought of that fish. In one swift move by Wilson, that feeling had been obliterated. My best was his bait. How, even after a few years of fishing, could it be that the gulf between Wilson and myself, between being a man or just a little boy, was actually widening? He had no idea what he was doing to me, of course. Hooking up the roach, he simply swung it out into the water under a large bright red float, and confidently commented, "When that goes, I'm in business." The final pike of the programme comes from the middle of the hole, which is how Wilson describes the slate-grey no-man's land where he has cast his bait. It is, of course, the beast we have all been waiting for. But incredibly, as Wilson battles it to the side of the boat, he describes it as only a small one. The giant pike writhes on a foam mat after he's got it into the net. It's long, 3 or maybe even 4 feet, with a dark muscular back leading on to a crocodilian head. "As fat as butter," exclaims Wilson jubilantly. He holds his fish up for the camera, and I get a good view of its mossy flanks. It's as if an artist has taken the time to delicately flick light yellow paint along a green pike-shaped canvas, then decided to finish the job by scraping through the lot with a yard brush. The fish's thick olive sides may be interspersed with pretty blonde flecks and subtle vertical stripes, yet the overall look and feel of the fish are of pure brute savagery. At the rear of the fish, a russet red and black striped dorsal fin stands erect and rounded. It is set so far back along the body it almost meets the tail fin. This intentional backloading of the pike's powerhouse affords it all the explosive forward motion it needs to intercept prey from a stationary position. Like the perch, they prefer to ambush their prey, but they can also take fish, frogs, and even ducks well out in open water. Such is their confidence in their own turn of speed. Somewhere towards the end of the program, Wilson rotates his fish so it is head-on to the camera lens. The skull is uniquely flattened in appearance, with large predatory eyes set unusually high on the sides, perfect for peering up from the depths and selecting its next victim. The grim jaw of Wilson's fish hisses open like a trapdoor, and I can't help but imagine what it must be like to have that as your last view on Earth. Horrid, I would expect. Absolute magic, says John victoriously. When the theme tune kicks in, I'm left alone with a feeling of raw inadequacy. I was 9, almost 10, and quite desperate for a pike of my own. It represented much more than just another fish. It symbolised growing up, doing something on my own, facing my fears, in short, being a man. But if the fish that Wilson caught in the film really was only a small one, and the bait he used as big as my personal best, then how could I ever expect to manage a pike for myself? The beginning of the winter of 92 saw me fish like I had never fished before. For 3 months straight, I was out almost every single night, drawing a triangular-shaped piece of shiny metal through every inch of the creek's brown water, but trapped deep in a piker's purgatory. Spinning for pike was my first major new fishing skill after 5 years of float fishing for the creek's roach and perch. Until that point, I'd been pretty much sat on my hands waiting for a bite. But spinning required constant movement of both myself and my hook to animate the spinner, literally to get it to spin and make it flash through the water like an injured silverfish. Winding the spinner in on my line would only last about 20 seconds in the narrow creek, which meant I was now casting many more times in a day than ever before. Given my earlier problems with this most basic of fishing skills, I felt I was now risking my end tackle almost twice a minute. To make matters significantly worse, I also learnt that the most likely pike-holding areas were right under the trees and along the reed beds, the very obstacles I'd spent the previous half decade trying to avoid casting towards. The arms of the trees and roots of the reeds might have been tackle thieves, but the shade and shelter they afforded the pike made them the perfect ambush points for any unsuspecting fish. To stand a chance of a pike, I had to land my spinner perfectly, firmly in the pike's lair and with an inch of the devastating grasp of the bankside bush. Grandad wasn't interested in helping at all. Pike fishing is too easy, he would say dismissively. Perhaps he understood this was a fish I needed to meet by myself, but the effect of his words was to heap yet more pressure on my infantile shoulders. If it really was easy, then why couldn't I just catch one? Looking back, I know precisely what the problem was. My retrieve was always too fast and too uniform. I would never let the spinner drop beneath the top 6 inches of surface water, meaning any interested pike would have to come right up off the bottom to grab it. Nor did I vary the speed of my draw to allow the lure vital space to flit and flutter along like a wounded fish, meaning, in the eyes of a predator, that my spinner was in fact a turbocharged superfish with a full bill of health. Zipping my spinner along the creek's surface merely served to give onlookers the impression I was a man out pike fishing, the man I wanted them to believe I was, while, in reality, I was never really giving myself a chance of hooking my quarry. Effectively, I was a rank boxing amateur, dancing round the undefeated prize fighter without ever really getting close enough to throw a meaningful punch or get hit myself. I was simply too terrified of the potential consequences of hooking a pike, and too bloody-minded to just give up. There is a unique existential crisis brought on by anyone seriously into pike fishing. Why am I here is a question that will inevitably pass the lips of this peculiar breed of angler. Fish are as much a product of their environment as are the people who angle for them. Carp, with their fat scales, soft mouths and friendly curves, have the look and feel of summer, to be had from lily-strewn ponds and picture-perfect lakes. The typical carp angler prefers fairer weather and appears built for comfort, not speed. Paradoxically, though, the fatter the carp, the slimmer and more pathological the bent of the carp fisherman. And no one should doubt that even the laziest-looking carp and carper has an extraordinary turn of pace when it is required. The barbel's golden hue is classic autumn. Its angular fins are shaped and coloured like an early leaf drop, and the torpedo shape marks this fish out as a specimen of fast water. The barbel fisherman, like the fish, is a shrewd and romantic character, a lover of nature and hardy too, easily capable of withstanding stormy weather and early starts. But this angler can't match the pike and pike angler for sheer durability. They are the embodiment of winter, and both thrive on a rare form of neglect. Of course, you can catch pike in the summer, and there are many anglers who fish for all fish species all year round. But the pike are at their largest in midwinter, and it takes a very special breed of fishermen to convincingly morph their own character to match up to the deep cold their quarry prefers. As a child, I was a pretender, a mere sheep in wolf's clothing. But unbeknown to me at the time, my dad was about to give me a big helping hand. On the creek, you know spring is around the corner as soon as the daffodils outnumber the snowdrops. Time was running out for my first pike and me. Soon the water would warm and the river fishing season would close till the 16th of June. I lay in my bed, near wild with frustration. I couldn't sleep that particular night for two distinct reasons. Firstly, I discovered Dad had taped over Flash Gordon at the precise moment he begins to turn things around in his fight to the death with Baron. And, "Flash, I love you, but we only have 14 hours to save the Earth," was now forever jump cut with Jeff Hamilton talking about manure on Gardener's World. Naturally, I was furious, but the second reason I was counting sheep was considerably more devastating. Just as Mum and Dad had been going to bed, I had overheard them have the following conversation right outside my room. "Will is spending a lot of his time fishing at the moment, even more than normal," said Mum, standing on the landing as Dad came up the stairs. "He's trying to catch a pike," replied Dad. "Really?" answered Mum, with audible concern in her voice. "Isn't that dangerous?" "Not really," said Dad, "but don't worry. He won't get one in. He's not strong enough." The words slapped my eardrum and tore straight into my heart. Instantly, I could feel hot tears filling up my face and beelining for my tear ducts. It was the first time I had ever heard Dad doubt I could do anything. We had always been brought up on the principle that you can succeed at anything if you just try your best. Yet here he was saying that despite everything I was putting into it, I was never going to be good enough. I tried to cover my ears with the pillow and will his words to leave my brain. Every fear I'd suppressed to that point had been realised in full. The shadow of self-doubt reared up and smothered me in my bedsheets. Hours later, I was still very much awake. I gritted my teeth and thumped my fists on the duvet. Why would he say that? How dare he say that? I got up and looked at myself in the mirror. My sense of my own shortcomings was quickly being replaced with a wild rage. That was a total betrayal from Dad. I glowered back at myself. I would show him. I'd prove I did have the strength. In its elemental form, pike fishing necessitates in an individual a curious brand of madness. Crumbling docklands, isolated rivers and windswept reservoirs, the last places your average angler would choose to spend their time. But the purest piker casts into these locations with a sort of masochistic thrill, fearlessly fishing a fearful landscape for a fish seemingly without fear. In my late 20s, I fished a handful of times for pike in a long, narrow Fenland dike called the Cuckoo Drain. You could probably spend a lifetime searching through the names of waterways and not find one as ill-fitting as the Cuckoo moniker given to this place. The Cuckoo throws up more than simply the iconic bird sound of spring. It is the vision of renewal, a glade filled with fresh-sprung wildflowers, an oaken woodland rousing itself after a week of rain. The resurgence and resilience of life, a clarion call to heat the soul, reminding us that winter has passed and the good times are here once more. The Cuckoo Drain in winter was miles of pure brutality. Its near unrelenting misery placed it well amongst the hardest places I have ever fished. Thus, it was near perfect for big pike. It took some time simply to find the place, tucked as it was, tight between a pumping station and a dip between two brown fields that stretched on ad infinitum. As all Fenland drains contain pike of some measure, and with Cuckoo both being deep and sporting a good head of shoaling roach and bream, it seemed fair to assume there might well be some decent-sized resident fish. This assumption was backed up by the only person I ever saw down there besides me, a typical piker, tall and grizzled with a rugged ginger beard and slightly gaunt appearance. He strongly resembled a starving Viking. Few words were wasted between him and me. "Anything doing?" he would mumble. I would answer in the negative and repeat his question back to him. "Nothing doing," he'd respond with a sniff. I was really quite intimidated. I decided to take a small spinning rod and had huge early success with a trio of fine, averagely sized fish on my first outing. But from that moment forward, I really struggled. It was as if the drain itself had lured me in with the promise of Pike, only so it could then enjoy watching me endure an endlessly barren, ice-cold search along its desolate banks. After a dozen or so visits, I began to seriously question whether those early pike had been a mirage. Pike-shaped sprites, kelpies, spirits, or sirens? Even the Viking was nowhere to be seen by the bitter end of that bitterest of seasons. A barn owl would usually emerge when there was an hour of daylight remaining. It offered cold comfort, haunting the banks and circling my position like a ghostly vulture, just waiting for me to drop so it could pick apart my frozen carcass. It would take until my final visit for the drain to yield me another pike. A slamming take and dogged fight marked it out as a decent fish, a good double for sure. But as I reached down to slip my fingers into its gills, a hard head shake left only the tip of one hook in its stiff upper lip. I had been fishing with two treble hooks on a wire trace specifically designed for the bony mouth of the pike. The extra hook points, six in this case, should give you a greater chance of landing this hard-mouthed fish. But with just one hook hold left, I now stood a very slim chance of success unless I acted quickly. I tried to get a solid grip on the fish once more, but another violent headshake brought a tearing sound and the warming feeling of fresh blood spilling across my hands. The numbing cold had dampened my pain receptors to such an extent that it took several seconds more than it should for me to realise that all the blood was my own, and several more still to discern that it was not my fingers that had been sliced on the pike's teeth, but that one of the higher treble hooks had torn right through my trouser leg and embedded itself deep within my shin. Pike fishing leaves scars both real and imagined. I have two you can see, one livid white on my shin, the other right across the cornea of my right eye, where I almost lost my sight to the hooks of a spinner while pike fishing as a teenager. But these are a small price to pay in the mind of the truly serious piker. I needed to be made of sterner stuff if I was ever to land a monster. I drew a curtain over my last serious attempt at pike fishing that evening, bum shuffling and whimpering my way back up the bankside of Cuckoo Drain, a hook impaled in my leg, and a 10-pound pike dangling around my ankles. I've heard the pike once described as a gothic fish, and although I get where this reference is coming from, what with the pike's shadowy behaviour and angular appearance, I think prehistoric is a far fairer depiction of this truly primeval creature. The earliest British fossils of Esox luceus, to give the pike its Latin name, are dated at 500,000 years old. It is believed the fish first made its way to British shores via the North Sea land bridge, way back when the River Thames was connected to the River Rhine in the Netherlands. But the latest fossil dating of the Esox genus far predates even this, placing the pike in Northern America some 80 million years earlier. The pike's evolutionary masterstroke came sometime during the Cretaceous period, when the early Esox developed jaws capable of swallowing far greater sized prey than the other species within the herring salmon order. From that moment forward, the pike had set itself on an extraordinarily durable pathway that would see it survive several ice ages and spread its presence from America and right across Europe, eventually spanning almost the entire boreal forest region of the Northern Hemisphere. With its elongated body, sharpened head and penchant for aggression, the pike name stuck with the fish from the Middle Ages, aptly chosen for its resemblance to the tall thrusting spear favoured by the infantrymen of the time, and used for taking down knights on horseback with ruthless efficiency and maximum bloodshed, much like the fish might given the chance among a shoal of roach. The Wilson Encyclopedia describes an average size of between 5 and 12 pounds, with a mega specimen topping out at over 30 pounds. When I was still stuck angling for my first, Roy Lewis shocked the pike angling world with a whopping 46-pound 13-ounce beast from Llandegfeth Reservoir in South Wales. That record still stands today, taken on little more than a small and humble-looking wooden lure called the Creek Chub Pikey. There is no other fish species on these shores to have sprung quite the same degree of myth and legend as the pike. The Yorkshire Terrier that didn't make it home from its paddle in the park pond? The toothy beast that supposedly went for the ankles of a small swimming boy? The bleached bones of the 90-pound fish washed up on the banks of some far-flung Irish loch? All unreliably witnessed, yet all somehow difficult to debunk completely. Just look at that image of the pike caught by Roy Lewis. It is an enormous spawn-filled female fish that appears almost as long as Roy himself. Is it such a leap in imagination to make real the violent water monsters of our childhood, then? The answer is probably yes, it is. The genuinely big fish have nearly always fallen from the drains and lakes that have seen very little pike angling pressure or human presence. The pike certainly would not attack a human without any prior provocation. In this day and age, the real specimens are to be found lurking safely within trout fishing-only reservoirs, or concealed somewhere within mile upon mile of undisturbed lake or drain. They prefer the forgotten edges of our nation, you see. The sort of places where you could still quite easily fish for a lifetime without even laying eyes on a Wilson mega specimen. And the big old pike can while away their lives well away from our disturbing habits. Big pike need food though, and lots of it. That's why I'm told many of these stock trout lakes tend to do so well in sustaining monsters. But more than that, they require a healthy ecosystem and a relative lack of competition. You should never consider culling pike in order to produce a bigger, better stamp of fish though, or to protect the other fish in the water, for that matter. Many a world-class pike venue has been destroyed by the unwise attempt to remove its resident predators. And unless you get them all, and really, why would you want to do that? There will inevitably be an explosion of smaller pike that would have otherwise been controlled by the larger cannibalistic fish. In a pike's world, the only fish that truly controls the pike is the pike. I first began looking for a big pike for this book in January, but it took until the middle of the month before a sudden break in the rain seemed to offer a true chance of a catch. Overcast, grey, a slight rise in temperature from single to double digits. It wasn't consistent with the forecast at all. I rushed from my desk and straight out to the garden pond to find my goldfish milling around on the surface and even feeding. Potentially the biggest catch of the season was on. Pike feed at ill-defined times. You can convince yourself there are no pike at all in a place, and then a small change in atmospherics brings them onto the feed, and suddenly you're in. I've heard of anglers catching nearly 100 pike in just a few hours of ferocious action. Then, as quickly as they're turned on, they're all off again, often for hours, sometimes even for days. Of course, the pikers are left scratching their heads and wondering where they're all hiding, but there is a widely held belief that these small rises in temperature can bring the pike out of their stupor. With even the goldfish showing some signs of life this morning, it was all looking very good indeed. The problem I faced was that it was now far too late to grab a ticket at any one of the certified big pike venues. And with all the rivers still flooded, I needed to think out of the box. John Ellis, the canals, of course. I flicked the laptop on and used Google Maps to zoom right in on the small network of drains and canals that ran around Cardiff. The one area I was particularly interested in stumbled off a giant space of disused industrial-era docks called the Atlantic Wharf. If Big Pike thrived on neglect, then this place surely hid a giant. It's only about half a mile from a glitzy shopping centre, but it may as well have been on Mars. The blackened remains of rusting high-tower cranes hang over this place, looming large and lifeless over the water like Jurassic-era herons. An unattractive, busy main road runs right along one side of the water too, but there were big fish to be had here if you only knew where to look. I had already started my quest for a big pike there at the year's turn, but I hadn't yet had much luck. I did have some definite follows though, predatory swells at the surface as my lure came back under my rod tip, and on one occasion, a savage take tore my rubber lure clean in two, narrowly missing the hook, and leaving me with little more than the grinning head of my replica eel. The other people who fished there tended to be a special breed, but they were friendly enough, as long as you didn't ask too many questions about permits or carry on like a member of the Cardiff City Council. The first time I ventured down there, I met an enormous shaven-headed man in a state of some despair. "Fuckers nicked all my meat and my rods in the night," he raged, eyes popping from their sockets and his mobile clutched firmly to his ear. I presumed to the police. I was a bit pissed up last night, to be fair, but they could at least have not cooked up all my fucking meat on my fucking barbecue, not 10 fucking meters from my fucking tent. He was near apoplectic with rage, which was understandable given he'd just woken to discover nearly everything he owned had been stolen. There was no fishing club looking after Atlantic Wharf back then, so the fishing was effectively free, but there is always some price to pay. Some of the local pike fishermen here had an uneasy relationship with both the law and the rules. A few openly admitted to fishing illegally in nature reserves, and one even told me he was banned from the local Glamorgan Anglers Club for using live ducklings as bait. Grim, almost beyond belief. Eventually, I was trusted enough to be shown the pictures of the pike they had caught. Blurry pictures of half-cut anglers with what were quite clearly significantly large fish in their hands. Some of the pike looked to be over 25 pounds. Perhaps one was even pushing the magic 30-pound mark. Just beware fishing too long alone after dark, I was warned, and keep an eye out for the poachers and prostitutes. The royalty stretch of the Hampshire Avon, this was not. Poaching is a growing problem in Britain, particularly in these little visited urban hinterlands that kiss up against large populations of people. For years, I disregarded those who talked of poachers taking all of the fish as just having fishermen's excuses. But John Ellis had been quick to point the finger too, claiming all it takes is a replica lock key to drain an entire stretch of canal in the middle of the night and make off with fish worth upwards of £2,000. In recent times, I'd encountered more less than formal approaches, gill nets and long lines dumped on the banks, tragically emptied of their quarry when no one else was around. Many of my non-fishing friends don't really see the point of the sport if all you are ever doing is catching fish only to put them back. I know plenty of anglers who also believe there is no harm in taking the occasional sample, but the hard reality is that our inland fish stocks would simply collapse if everyone started to take their catches home. The few places where you can do it, trout and salmon fisheries for example, have very carefully managed and monitored restocking programs, strict limits on your catch, and fastidious attention to the paperwork every angler must complete if he or she intends to take a fish home. Our island nation is too small and too overpopulated to expect our recovering freshwater to handle anything other than catch and release. And when it comes to removing pike, the top fish predator, the resultant effect on an ecosystem can be devastating. It was one of the many reasons why predator anglers are so secretive about their catches. I felt the canals feeding the wharf were easily my best bet for lure fishing. The wharf was deep enough to take giant coal tankers and industrial container ships in its heyday, so this little spike in temperature wouldn't have even registered in those depths. However, in the relative shallows of the canals, the water would be responding almost instantaneously. I hoped to find the shoals of overwintering silverfish holed up somewhere in there, which would, in turn, be drawing the big pike up off the wharf and deep into the canal system to feed, like great white sharks on the trail of a giant chum slick of African sardines. I parked up with just an hour of light remaining in the day, the witching hour for predators the world over, and headed over to a small bridge overlooking a canal. It's hemmed in on all sides by a housing estate, a small ribbon of gently flowing water no more than 10 metres in width and a few feet deep. From this point, it's only a short walk to where it spills into the vast basin of water that forms the wharf, but upstream from here the canal disappears under the ground, cutting a subterranean path until it pops up behind a posh hotel and meets its maker, the River Taff. I had looked into entering those underground canal workings whilst researching stories for a BBC series on the river, even going so far as to find a local artist who had worked out a plan to sail them on the inflated inner tube of a tractor tyre. But the council had thwarted our plans. The king rats and giant eels of the perpetual dark would have to wait. Still, I peered hopefully off the bridge and into the water below, willing a daylight giant to materialise somewhere in the void below. Superficially, it couldn't be less welcoming. Hard slabs of concrete encase this narrow patch, and the water is clogged hard with storm-swept branches that reach to the heavens with their long skeletal fingers. The litter here is far worse than the stuff on the Grand Union Canal, and there's certainly no caring edge or quirky canal culture to be found in this forgotten space. The slack water teems with beer bottles, cans and plastics, and as the street lights flickered into life, a grimy orange hue was cast right across the scene, lighting up the canal like some bargain basement red light district. A series of gently expanding rings appear suddenly on the water's surface. Even here, there are signs of wildlife. It's a shoal of feeding fish, moving around in the upper layers of water, just as I'd hoped, basking in the relative warmth and snatching the very occasional fly or grub ensnared in the surface film. Perhaps I can dare to dream. Removing the 4-inch rubber lure from the end of my line, I quickly switch to a tiny spinner. These topping fish are small. I don't want to stand out too much from the crowd. I make my first cast and the water stirs with mass movement. Clearly there are a lot more silverfish here than I'd first thought. Seconds later, a pluck on the line is converted into a jarring take. It feels small and awkward, possibly a perch, but more likely just a foul-hooked fish. Yes, I've accidentally punctured a pristine roach right through its silvery side. I've massively underestimated this place. There are quite literally thousands of fish holed up in here. There's barely room in the water to work my spinner without risking hooking one in error. Another cast sees me lodged into something solid and inanimate on the canal bottom. I yank hard in an attempt to free the hooks and spook something very large to the left of my tightened line. It sends a V-shaped bow wave down the water and scatters hundreds of frightened roach across the surface in its wake. It just has to be a pike. A man with a pram filled with plastic bags wanders past, eyes down, followed by a jogger whose music is cranked up so loud I can almost hear the lyrics of the R&B song blasting from his headphones. I recast and immediately hook into a tiny pike. It writhes on the line as I ease it into the canal's side, splashing the surface and disturbing the water. That was a very bad move on this little pike's part. With little warning, the V-shaped wave is back, but this time it's coming straight for us. Time slows, and my heart rolls up towards my gullet. A monstrous pike emerges right beneath its victim. The little pike, the big pike and I, we all know what is coming next. In a flash, the larger has ingested the smaller, spinner and all, without any of it needing to touch the sides. As my line is still attached to the small pike, we both now have quite a problem. Realizing it is tethered, the monster projects itself clean out of the water in fright, using the power of its tail alone to skip impressively along the surface before crashing back into the pool with a thunderclap. I receive a full view of its extraordinary length during these acrobatics. It is in excess of 10 pounds. Perhaps not a big fish in terms of big pike, but a true giant for such a tiny canal. I try to keep tension on the line, but a microsecond of slack sees the hook dislodged, and as the fish belly flops its way back into the water, I realise we are sadly no longer in contact. A steady rain blisters the water as night falls hard and cold. The supreme power of the pike's re-entry has sent shockwaves slapping into the canal's concrete sides. Briefly, a single tennis ball is projected up onto the walkway. It rolls a wet trail for a few feet before landing back into the murk with a plop. I walk downstream towards the wharf, breathing heavily. I need to pull myself together fast. There is still a chance that the fish hasn't yet felt the steel of my hooks. It might just take another bait, but I know I must rest the swim before attempting anything else. Both the pike and I need time to consider our next moves. Clearly I'm on edge. A grey heron explodes from a thicket at my ankles and I momentarily leave my body in fright. Come on, Will, it's only a fish. Except it wasn't. That fish was a miracle out in that squash-court-sized patch of water. And right now, in this very moment, I'm probably the only person in the world that even knows it exists. In the desolate car park just before the wharf, a fight between two drug dealers breaks out. I try not to catch their eyes. They scream each other down about some aborted deal. With their identical enamel-white parka jackets and fur-lined hoods, they look like a pair of dueling swans, puffing out their chests and jostling for territory. I duck down and take a couple of speculative casts into the darkness of the wharf. snagging some weed and finding a sense of calm just in the process of removing the soft green matting from the trio of hooks at the end of my spinner. It's soon time to go back and try again. I underhand cast the spinner back into the same spot and get an instant slamming response from the monster. He's ready, and this time so am I. I heave hard against its bulk, in my mind setting the hook securely into its fang-filled mouth. But again, I feel the gut-wrenching give of a slack, fish-free line. I don't understand. Under a downstream bridge, a pair of boys smoke marijuana from a roll-up they're sharing. Its sweet smell drifts on the night air right down to my latest disaster. Edgily, they flick their lighter on and off. They haven't noticed my fish, my crisis, or me. I reel up and to my surprise discover that yet another small roach has found its way onto the hooks. This roach is in a truly sorry state, heavily lacerated with a severed spinal cord and a frozen expression. It has been thoroughly mangled by the pike, stone dead on arrival. Gently, I place a hook through its lower lip and flick it back in. This is now my last chance. Almost imperceptibly, the line starts to shudder and slide. Unbelievable luck. I wait, imagining the giant pike first taking the roach sideways in its mouth before turning it slowly towards its final journey on this earth. I take a deep, deep breath, wind down and lift into the fish as hard as I dare. Massive resistance gives way to a thunderous charge towards the bridge. The pot smokers have gone now. My reel screams as line escapes the spool at speed. There's no acrobatics to be had this time around, just dour, dogged confrontation. The pike steams right through the bridge and out the other side. I didn't think I was going to be able to stop it from rounding a bend in the canal at first, but at last it starts to yield to pressure. As the great pike inches to the surface, I drop to my knees. Here she comes like a thick green submarine. I steady myself as the head presents itself. There is only one spot on a pike where you can grasp it by hand without lacerating your fingers or hurting the fish. It's inside the mouth, right underneath the lower jaw by way of its hardened gill plates. With no time to put on a glove, I slide my hand into the cavity and lift. She's beautiful. A spawn-filled female, thick and so darkly marked that you could easily be staring right at her without ever realizing she's there. A metaphor for this canal system, if ever there was one. I roll out a soft mat to safely remove the hooks without causing any more disruption to her day, and spend a few moments on my knees, simply gazing at this precious sword from the stone. A man in a suit walks right past me without even acknowledging our presence. Even with the fish out of the water, the canal secrets remain invisible to those incapable of belief. I lie down on my chest and attempt to self-take a photo at arm's length, but I'm interrupted. Jesus Christ, mate! It's one of the boys from beneath the bridge, back with the remains of his spliff hanging at a comedic angle from his trembling lower lip. What the fuck is that? He pulls down the hood on his black Adidas tracksuit to reveal a tightly dreadlocked scalp. He attempts to take a photo with his phone, but his hands are shaking uncontrollably. Oh my days, said the lad, wiping his brow at the sheer intensity of the experience. I'm not going to lie, I've seen some crazy shit down here, but I ain't never seen anything like that. Together, we sat down next to the great fish, paying gentle homage as I showed him its mouth parts, fins and armour, before sliding her carefully back into the canal. Momentarily, the pike just sat on the shallow bottom, glowering right back up at us. That's crazy, he said. I know, I replied. It really was. A waft of her tail eventually sent her back to a life of obscurity, beneath a floating mat of litter. And my partner decided it was also time to make his own way back into the darkness. I watched him as he went, pulling his hood back over his head and sparking up the biggest spliff this side of Jamaica. If Grandad had been around today, we would have talked about that capture for weeks. But all I had was the Wilson Encyclopedia to pour my experience into. And all that came back was the cold hard fact that my fish wasn't a record breaker. In fact, it wasn't even anywhere close to being a Wilson mega specimen. A 30-pound pike is a very rare beast in itself, but a 40-pounder capable of threatening Roy Lewis's 46-pound 13-ounce record is almost beyond the realms of possibility. Scanning the list of the 50 biggest pike ever caught and immediately discounting the sketchy records, repeat captures, or those that are likely to now be deceased, I felt it was probably realistic to say there were fewer than 20 known 40-pound pike alive today in Britain, most of which were highly nomadic individuals living within immense expanses of water. Llangegfeth, the water that provided Roy with his record back in 1992, would have seemed the obvious place to start. But by the turn of the century, the water had headed into such a state of pike fishing decline that a 5-year hiatus on predator angling was called in 2010. By the time it reopened in 2015, there was already a new contender firmly on the block. 50 kilometres to the southeast, Somerset's Chew Valley Lake, or Chew, as it is affectionately known by pike anglers, was crushing all comers. 2015 saw an astonishing trio of pike over 40 pounds grace Chew's banks, and with a further 17 fish of over 30 pounds falling in just the first week of the pike season, it was no longer a question of whether Chew was the number one pike water in the UK, but whether it could actually be one of the greatest of all time. From the moment Chew's super-sized pike started hitting the angling press, I was quite literally desperate to fish there. If I was ever going to stand any realistic chance of catching a record-breaking pike, then clearly Chew was the place to go. But simply getting tickets to pikefish the place represented an immense challenge of will and patience. There are only two periods in a year you can actually fish for pike on Chew. One 2-week spell in February and a second longer spell running through October and November. These are known as the pike trials, and the only way of getting tickets is to call the lodge landline on the first Saturday after the Christmas and New Year holidays. With every serious pike angler in Britain jamming up the line, for the strict limit of 25 boats and 20 bank tickets, the odds of getting a result are extremely slim. No one could say it wasn't fair. Everyone is equally unlikely to win this lottery. It endeared Chew to me no end. Predominantly, it was a trout fishing water that happened to contain monstrous pike. No one wanted to outright deny pike anglers the opportunity to catch the fish of a lifetime, but equally, the owners felt they had a duty of care to their bread-and-butter trout anglers, and, as we already know, big pike hate attention. As if the odds weren't already stacked against me, the Great Chew phone-in landed on the 9th of January, the morning after the World Darts quarter-finals at the Lakeside. It took the most almighty effort just to find my phone that morning, but I was present and correct at 9 a.m, albeit barefoot and surrounded by pizza boxes and screwed up tickets from the night before. Our hero, Scotty Dog Mitchell, had been knocked out. I took a deep, fortifying breath and began punching in the number. An hour passed as I notched up my first 100 unsuccessful calls. I was then joined by my bleary-eyed mate, Stuart, who deployed both his landline and his mobile phone, effectively tripling my chances, but it was all to be in vain. We ceremoniously called it a day once we had heard the engaged tone for the 1,000th time. "I guess that's why they call it the Pike Trials, mate," said Stuart, while looking for his van keys. He could see how much it meant to me. I appreciated that. We sloped off to the semi-finals and I tried my best to thoroughly drown my sorrows. I eventually got through 3 days later. The polite West Country man on the phone told me all the spots for 2016 were long since gone. The horse had not only bolted before the stable door was closed, he was in the next town and midway through a national lecture tour on farm security. The man told me there were now a raffle and an auction to try for. I failed in the former, and the latter topped out at an extraordinary £880 for a single day on a boat. There was nothing more I could do. I was just going to have to look elsewhere for my chance. With Chew gone and Llangegfeth out of the running, I had to find another big trout water fast. Closer to my childhood home, there were the Grafham and Rutland reservoirs, but the really big pike had been curiously absent there for the last few seasons. Over in the Brecon Beacons, there was Llanghorse Lake, famously referenced in the Doomsday Book of Mammoth Pike for producing the world's biggest ever pike in 1846 to the rod of a Mr. Owen, a giant fish weighing an alleged 68 pounds. But that was unsubstantiated, and would have been dead for well over 100 years. I called up the kindly owner anyway, and he readily admitted that, although the lake certainly had potential, it realistically couldn't ever compete with Chew for the sheer size of pike. The last big fish there was a 32-pounder in 2007. It wasn't looking good. I had one last avenue to try, but I knew this was an even longer shot than Chew. Scarborough's Wycombe Lakes had a lot going for them on paper. Currently the biggest known living pike in Britain, a giant 46-pound 11-ounce fish, was resident in their waters. And at only 7 acres, to choose 1,000+, the odds of a record-breaking hookup were dramatically reduced. However, access to pike fish the water was strictly restricted to members of an exclusive syndicate. I fired off a hopeful email and was extremely surprised to get a quick response inviting me to speak to Jake Finnegan, the fisheries manager. Jake was a politely spoken and articulate northerner who clearly cared deeply about the fish in his lake. I wanted to get a feeling of what it must be like to look after a water with such a legendary fish, a real-life Loch Ness monster, a proper, tangible lake beast. And then I wanted to nonchalantly request special permission to have a crack at it. I was going to have to play my cards very carefully indeed, but Jake tripped me up within moments of answering my call. "She's been out on 6 occasions over the last 5 years," he began. "First she was 39 pounds, 15 ounces, back in November 2010. He paused. "It was me that caught her then, actually." "Sorry, Jake, can I stop you there? I presumed I'd misheard. You just said you caught the pike first." This was an absolute bombshell. I stammered on, but my carefully loaded questions on fish care, leading up to a request to fish the lake, had just flown clean out of the window. "Tell me exactly how it happened." I leant into the phone and tore a fresh sheet of paper from my notebook. "It was just a trout lake back then, and this fish was a total unknown. People aren't totally sure how she even got in there. Some think she was placed in, but I reckon she most likely travelled up the becks and streams that flow to the River Derwent, right back when this whole place was flooded some years ago. From that point, she's obviously just gotten bigger and bigger." It was more than plausible that a small pike had made its way into this trout lake. And with rich pickings and freshly stocked trout, she would have piled on the poundage, up to 4 pounds a year for the best weight-gaining predators. "The water here is deep," Jake continued, 28 foot in places, "and has been stocked with trout for some 30-odd years. It wasn't hard for it to hide, I guess, but the occasional trout angler talked of seeing a really big fish chasing their trout on the retrieve." He took a deep breath. "Honestly, though, Will, we all thought the most it could be was 30 pounds. I'd seen a few photos of this pike from its most recent captures. It was incomprehensibly enormous. A long, fat female fish with a back so wide you could fit it with a saddle. My personal best pike was a 22-pound fish caught from the depths of the fens when I was 25 years old. I couldn't reasonably imagine tackling a pike nearly twice that size. And nor, it turned out, could Jake. A couple of trout anglers had returned their boat early one evening, so I just hopped in for nothing more than a 20-minute mess about. I liked that. A mess about that led to the biggest single pike discovery since the turn of the century. I went out in the boat around the edge of the lake. It was right at the end of the day, and I was on my last couple of casts, making my way back to where the boats were all kept when suddenly the big girl took my spinner. At first I thought it was just a trout of a couple of pounds. She didn't really do that much, just headed straight in towards me. Then I saw it for the first time. That's where the fight truly began. I couldn't believe it." I couldn't believe it either. What a story. He went on to say that by the time he had the fish under control, he realised the net he had with him wasn't anywhere near large enough to fit her in, and that he had then been forced to use the electric motor on board to get within shouting range of the shore. By a supreme stroke of good fortune, a colleague eventually managed to net her, tail first, before the fish could free itself from the tether. He had just landed the fish that would go on to become both the English record and the largest known living pike in the United Kingdom today. His previous personal best was just 14 pounds. It was, and still is, a fishing miracle. "You just don't know how to feel when it happens. You're gobsmacked." That was where the good times ended for Jake and the pike. News of the giant fish travelled fast, and Wycombe had to immediately limit the number of pike anglers allowed on the water. She next came out just 4 months after Jake had first caught her, but, astonishingly, the fish was some 6 pounds heavier. Now, with her just one meal away from being the next British record, interest in the fishery reached fever pitch. Jake was soon bombarded with requests to fish the lake for the pike. "Look, it's a trout lake at the end of the day," he said, with more than a touch of exasperation. Trout fishing was getting compromised. I had guys ringing up to inquire about trout fishing that couldn't get through because of all the interest from pike anglers. The syndicate seemed the best way to go then, limit it to 10 anglers with a maximum of 4 a day on the water. I know it's very exclusive, but I prefer this run as a trout lake with the pike as something of a bonus. The amount of pressure she'll get is overwhelming if I don't do something. At least on Chew they've got more than one 40-pound fish and over 1,000 acres for them to disappear into. Here she's on her own with just 7. That last comment struck me hard. I started to feel a sense of real guilt. This wasn't what fishing should be about. "Pike groups are getting more and more abrasive, just like the carp groups, in fact," continued Jake. "You can't post a photo anywhere without someone tearing into you over something. Every time our fish gets caught, you've got one big group of people saying we're running it like an exclusive club, and then there's another big group of people saying it's going to be a dead fish within a year. We've had one guy who said this time around, 'I know I said last time it will be a dead fish next year, but this time I really mean it. Next year it will be dead. What are we supposed to do? We just can't win.'" Clearly Jake had a point. You've got to really look after these big individual fish. I started to wonder if this pike was more of a curse than a blessing. "If only I could turn back the clock, I'd make this lake invitation only for pike fishing and that's it," he said with finality. For the first time in my entire fishing life, I didn't want to catch a fish. Jake was right. Pike fishing was going the same way as carp fishing, and chasing named and known fish into potential oblivion on small waters was not cool at all. It was actually quite disturbing. By the end of our conversation, I no longer wanted to ask him for permission to fish. In fact, I was quite embarrassed at myself. I wonder what Grandad would make of it all. I knew what he'd think, actually. He'd laugh at me and question why anyone would ever place value on such a short-sighted pursuit. Without me needing to say, Jake offered to set me up with a couple of the guys on the syndicate and potentially, with their permission, have a little fish for the big one. I told him how grateful I was for the offer, and really meant it, but there was no real mystery around this pike anymore. It was still a challenge of sorts, but Jake's original discovery and capture were the real purest piece of angling. That's what was really impressive. That's what I wanted for myself. Barring a miracle, any hopes I now had of angling for a record pike were fundamentally over. There wasn't much more I could do. Jake was spot on for trying to keep his fish safe in a small water, and Chew were doing the same by massively limiting their numbers and restricting the pike fishing windows. The start of Chew's February pike trials saw bad weather and a few blowouts. The 880-pound angler didn't get his day out due to high winds, and I managed a couple more sessions down the wharf and canals, but returned empty-handed. One afternoon I went to Gary Evans Tackle, my local Cardiff shop and a tackle enthusiast's haven, and chatted to my friends Rich and Andrew about pike. "I reckon there's a chance of a big one in the bay," suggested Andrew. "We've all been catching big perch down there all year." I told them about the fishing I'd been doing on the canal and down the wharf, and Andrew showed me a picture of a young bloke with a huge 16-pound sea trout from one of the feeder streams. "Yep, the Docklands are doing really well," continued Andrew, stowing his phone back in his pocket. "I've had loads of small pike down there, but the carp fishermen reckon they keep seeing really big pike battling it out with the rats." That sounded pretty much in keeping with that particular set of docks. It's a pike-eat-rat world down there. "I've had a really big pike, and I mean a really big one, chasing my floating frog lures down there on several occasions," Andrew continued. "But there is something about that lure that the big pike really doesn't like. He keeps turning away right at the last minute." He looked to his fingernails with a touch of embarrassment. "So I bought a lure shaped like a rat." I didn't even know there was such a thing, but Andrew knew everything that was worth knowing about lure fishing. And besides, it wasn't like I didn't get it. I'd once spent an entire afternoon fishing with a pot noodle on a whim. "I'm going to be trying that soon," he said, suddenly far sure of himself before a ringing phone took him back to his work. I left the tackle shop wondering about making a proper effort on the wider docks, as well as the wharf, or at least buying myself a rat lure and joining Andrew. In my heart, though, I couldn't help but think that this was feeling very much like needling.